Hi, this is the September 2024 edition of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Radio volunteer, Kathy Danaher. The headline on the cover of the September issue is The Battle Over TikTok. A new law could lead to a TikTok ban in the United States. Why are lawmakers so worried about the popular social media app? On the cover is the picture of an American bald eagle fiercely holding a cell phone in its sharp golden beak, giving the impression that it is taking the phone right out of a person's hand. Let's turn the page, and we first begin with an article in Geography titled Salt of the Earth. The photo on pages 2 and 3 is of the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah. Water from an ancient lake once reached nearly 1,000 feet above the salt flats' current surface. The pictures also show a man walking through a shallow layer of water on the flat lands of salt. The photo in the upper right shows drivers testing jet-powered cars that can reach over 600 miles per hour when they race across the salt flats. This man might seem to be wading into a huge body of water, but it is really a giant puddle just a few inches deep. And underneath lies an even more unusual surface, a vast flatland of salt. Welcome to the Bonneville Salt Flats, one of Utah's rare natural features. The surface of this 30,000-acre area is a layer of salt crystals up to 5 feet thick. Most of it is the same stuff that's in the shaker on your dinner table, sodium chloride. This place was once the site of Lake Bonneville, an immense ancient lake. For thousands of years, it covered one-third of what is now Utah, plus parts of Idaho and Nevada. About 16,000 years ago, Lake Bonneville started to shrink as the climate grew warmer and drier. As its waters disappeared, salt deposits were left behind. Though the salt crust is usually dry on the surface today, mud lies just beneath it. What about the flats part of the name? For a stretch of about 12 miles long and 5 miles wide, the Bonneville Salt Flats are almost perfectly level. That makes the site irresistible to car designers, test car drivers, and motorcyclists. They flock there to test their vehicles at high speeds. To protect the special surface from all that action, a group called Save the Salt repairs any damage. Each spring, it pumps a super salty water mixture onto the ground. That helps keep the flats bright and crusty. Next, on page 4, under U.S. and World News, sports. And the topic is, will college athletes cash in? For the first time in history, colleges may pay students to play sports. On the top of this page, we see a picture of Colorado Buffalo's football team quarterback, Shouter Saunders, and a photo of UConn basketball player, Paige Becker. College sports are big business. They make some universities tens of millions of dollars a year, and top coaches rake in million-dollar salaries. Student athletes, however, have had limited ability to profit from their performances, but that could soon change. The National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA, governs college sports. It allows student athletes to accept scholarships toward college costs. It also, as of 2021, lets them profit from their name, image, and likeness. That means they can do things like sell autographs or accept money for advertising products. But the NCAA has long banned student athletes from getting paid to play. It says their focus should be on their education, not on making money. Now, After a legal battle with student athletes, the NCAA has agreed to a deal that would allow schools to each share about $20 million of their sports income with athletes every year. In addition, some current and former athletes would receive pay going back to 2016. If a judge approves the agreement, these changes could take effect by next fall. Turning to page 5, the article is entitled, The No Styrofoam Ninja. Madhvi Chatur, 13, recently scored a major victory in the fight against plastic waste. She helped create a Colorado state law banning the use of styrofoam takeout containers at restaurants. The ban, which took effect this past January, also bars single-use plastic bags at most retail stores. Madhvi, who has a black belt in Taekwondo, calls herself the No Styrofoam Ninja. She's been on a mission to help the environment for years. At just age 5, she was inspired to take action after watching a documentary on plastic pollution. The United States produced about 40 million tons of plastic waste in 2021. That's according to a report by the environmental groups Last Beach Cleanup and Beyond Plastics. It can take hundreds of years for styrofoam and other plastic waste to break down. Inspired to make a difference in her state, Madhvi collected signatures, wrote emails, and spoke before lawmakers to help get the bill passed. She also met with about 35 mayors from around the state and talked about the ban with restaurant and business owners. Madhvi says she isn't done fighting for the planet, and she hopes others will follow her lead. I want everybody to turn into ninjas, she says, and refuse styrofoam and plastics. The photo on the top of the page is of Madhvi Chatur watching the governor of Colorado sign the styrofoam bill into law in 2021, which went into effect this year. Also on page 5, under the topic of culture, Hawaii's official hello. Many people greet their friends with a fist bump or a high five. People in Hawaii also use another gesture, the shaka. The hand signal is made by sticking out your thumb and pinky while folding down your middle three fingers and sometimes twisting your wrist. It could soon become an official greeting in Hawaii. In May, lawmakers there passed a bill that would make the shaka the official state gesture. The bill also recognizes Hawaii as the shaka's birthplace. When this issue went to press, Hawaii's governor was expected to sign the bill into law. For Hawaiians, the shaka has a variety of meanings, such as hello, goodbye, aloha, and thank you. The hand signal is believed to be more than a century old. State Senator Glenn Wakai, who introduced the bill, says the shaka is important because it captures what's special about Hawaii. It is a symbol of happiness, he explains. And on the right of the article is a photo of someone's hand demonstrating how to make a shaka greeting. Turning to page 6, we see a drawing of the American bald eagle using its strong beak to pull a cell phone out of a person's hand. The same picture that is on the cover of this month's Junior Scholastic. And the feature article is titled, The Battle Over TikTok. Here's what you need to know. You're happily scrolling through your TikTok feed. As usual, it's an entertaining mix of content. A clip of a hamster making a funny face is followed by one of a chef pouring hot sauce on ice cream. Yum! Then, a video pops up of your friend nailing a 360-degree skateboard flip. Epic, you comment, adding a fire emoji. Time flies when you're on TikTok, but soon you may not be able to spend any time on the popular video app, at least not in the United States. This past April, the U.S. government passed a law that will ban TikTok nationwide unless the app is sold to a buyer that the government approves of. If TikTok is not sold, the ban could take effect as early as January. Why? TikTok is the country's fastest-growing social media app, with 170 million American users. But it's owned by a Chinese company, and some U.S. lawmakers fear the Chinese government could spy on Americans through TikTok or use it to spread false information. Both, they say, would put the safety of the U.S. and its people at risk. So far, TikTok isn't backing down. TikTok and its owner, a tech company called ByteDance, have sued the U.S. government. They argue that banning TikTok violates the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That amendment guarantees the right to free speech. A column on the right side of page 7 explains exactly what the First Amendment is. It was added to the Constitution in 1791, and this amendment protects the five key freedoms. The freedom of religion. The government can't create an official religion or stop people from practicing their own faith or no faith. Number 2, speech. The government can't ban personal expression simply because it is controversial or unpopular. Number 3, the press. The government can't control what newspapers or other news outlets report. Number 4, assembly. People can publicly gather or protest for any cause as long as they do it peacefully. And number 5, petition. The government has to let people voice their ideas and concerns, such as through letters and lawsuits. The First Amendment does have limits, however. For example, the government can restrict speech that represents a clear and present danger, such as falsely shouting fire in a public place and causing panic. Experts say the battle to save TikTok could go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Will TikTok end up being deleted? TikTok's mission is to inspire creativity and bring joy. The app connects 1 billion people around the world, giving them a way to share and view short videos. Scrolling through, you can explore everything from national news to the latest dance craze. But while you watch videos, TikTok collects your personal information. Like other social media apps, TikTok tracks what users search for, share, like, and much more. If you're under 13, tech companies can't legally collect or share that information without your parent or guardian's permission. TikTok, Meta, and other tech companies use the data to improve their products. For instance, it helps them suggest content you'll like, but these companies also sell the personal information they collect. Outside businesses want it for their own reasons, such as to create personalized ads. Did you ever look at jeans online and then see ads for those jeans for months afterwards? Now you know why. What sets TikTok apart from other social media apps is its connection to China. China is run by the Chinese Communist Party. In a communist system, the government controls many parts of people's lives. It severely limits their personal freedoms and owns most land and businesses. As a result, Chinese officials can demand access to the data of any person or company based in China. That means ByteDance might have to show the Chinese government your private messages, who your friends and family are, and even your location at any moment. Many U.S. lawmakers say it is important to keep Americans' data out of the Chinese government's hands. That's because the U.S. and China have a complicated history. Having access to detailed information about 170 million Americans could be a powerful weapon for China, some lawmakers argue. It might sound like a Hollywood thriller, but Chinese espionage is real, said James Lewis. He is an expert on cybersecurity at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. China uses its technology to spy on people, says Lewis. And you might say, I'm only a kid. Why would they spy on me? We don't know, but they do. Many U.S. lawmakers say China could also use TikTok to spread propaganda, information that is circulated to make people think a certain way. It could promote false statements or highlight certain stories over others. Before a U.S. election, for example, TikTok could flood users' feeds with positive videos about a candidate who has pro-China policies. Cybersecurity experts point to the 2016 U.S. presidential election as an example. Before people voted, a political company took private data from 50 million Facebook users without their permission. It used details about their friend networks, likes, and political views to create personalized ads. The company's goal was to influence how those on Facebook users would vote. The photo on the top of page 8 shows a group of TikTok users standing in front of the Capitol building in support of the app. They're all holding up signs saying why they do not want TikTok to be banned. And some of them say, TikTok changed my life for the better. And TikTok helped me grow my business. Such security fears have already led the United States, as well as Australia, Canada, and several European countries, to ban TikTok from government employees' work phones and computers. More than 30 U.S. state governments have done the same. The potential ban passed in April would apply to the devices of all Americans. Both the Democratic and Republican lawmakers say it will help protect the United States. U.S. Senator Mark Warner is a Democrat from Virginia. He says Congress has received top-secret information about China's ability to use TikTok against the United States. The details have not been made public. U.S. Senator Marco Rubio is a Republican from Florida. He agrees the app is dangerous. We are united in our concern about the national security threat posed by TikTok, a platform with enormous power to influence and divide Americans, he said this past March in a joint statement with Warner. Before Congress passed the TikTok bill, several lawmakers said they hoped the app would survive for Americans to enjoy, but only with a new owner. The new owner doesn't need to be a U.S. company, Warner explained, but it does need to be from a country that is on good terms with the United States. I want to make clear to all Americans, this is not an effort to take your voice away, Warner said. TikTok officials, meanwhile, say they would never turn over Americans' personal details to China. Right now, TikTok is in the process of moving its U.S. data to servers owned and operated by a Texas-based company. That will put the information out of China's reach, says Xu Zhiqu, TikTok's chief executive officer. The bottom line is this. American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel, Chu told Congress last year. In addition, TikTok and ByteDance argue that the new law goes against the Constitution because it limits Americans' right to express themselves. Kate Ruan agrees. She is the director of the Free Expression Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, D.C. Banning people from using TikTok takes away their right to freely speak on the app, she says. The graph on page 9 shows that the top 5 social media platforms in order of U.S. adult users are YouTube, Facebook, then Instagram, Pinterest, and TikTok actually comes in last. Kate Ruan continued, Congress wants to censor TikTok, and as a result, they are fine censoring the people in the United States that use it to create or to support their businesses or get their news. TikTok and ByteDance say the law also puts other companies at risk. If Congress can do this to TikTok, their lawsuit states, U.S. lawmakers could force any company to be sold simply by calling it a security risk. Plus, TikTok supporters point out, the U.S. has long championed free expression for everyone. It has spoken out against countries like China for censoring online content. If the U.S. bans TikTok, other countries might follow its lead and ban U.S.-owned apps that support free speech, like Snapchat or Instagram. That could be dangerous, Ruan warns. Social media is an important outlet for exchanging information and ideas, she says. This can be especially true in countries where people have limited freedoms. So what happens next? The legal battle is expected to last months, but some experts say TikTok has an advantage. TikTok has successfully challenged earlier efforts to ban it. Last year, for example, a federal judge temporarily blocked a TikTok ban passed by Montana lawmakers. The judge said the ban likely violated the First Amendment. The case was on hold when this issue of Junior Scholastic went to press. If TikTok loses in court, would the app be sold? ByteDance executives say no. Plus, the Chinese government has said it wouldn't approve a sale. Even if the ban is upheld, TikTok won't immediately disappear from your device in January. But American app stores would not be allowed to offer it. Updates and tech fixes wouldn't get through. Eventually, the app would stop working. Would saying goodbye to TikTok make us more secure? Many privacy experts say no. They point out that other social media networks sell our details. China could likely buy Americans' data if they wanted to. That's why Congress is considering a federal privacy law that would protect all of our digital data. It would limit the information that companies can collect. It would also require companies to tell us where that information goes. Ruan is among those who support such a law. If we approach it that way, she says, we would protect everybody's data on every app, and we could still watch all those cute hamster videos. On the top of page 10 are some suggestions on how to protect your privacy when online. They include not using your full name or phone number on an app, not sharing your contacts, and creating a login that is unique and specific to each account in case someone guesses your password. On page 11, America's Online Shopping Revolution. This year, Amazon turns 30. How has the online shopping giant transformed our lives and our society? When 13-year-old Nora Miller needed to buy something, she doesn't head to a store. "I feel like shopping online is so much quicker," says the eighth grader from Stowe, Massachusetts. "You just press a button and you can see all the options. You can browse for all the time you want." The introduction of the e-commerce company Amazon 30 years ago helped make that possible. Amazon's success sparked the growth of an entire e-commerce industry, and that has transformed the way we shop. About 20% of all retail sales now happen online. With more than $6.3 trillion in global sales predicted for this year alone. That is according to eMarketer, a market research company that tracks shopping trends. Amazon has radically changed the shopping experience, says Barbara Kahn, a professor at the Wharton School of Business in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It is responsible for the total acceptance these days of online shopping. Back in 1994, when Jeff Bezos founded Amazon, it was a lot harder to buy stuff. Sometimes you had to try several stores. There were often lines at checkout. And if a store was closed or didn't have what you needed, you were out of luck. Bezos started Amazon as an online bookstore, but he had a much bigger vision for its future, to make it the everything store. In 1998, Amazon started offering other kinds of products. By 2000, the company reported about $2.7 billion in annual sales. Its success and the success of other e-commerce sites like eBay inspired more online stores to open. A major part of online shopping's appeal was, and still is, convenience, says Praveen Kopali. He is a marketing professor at the Tuck School of Business in Hanover, New Hampshire. "You can shop from anywhere," Kopali explains. "E-commerce also offers flexibility," he adds. "When you walk into a store, you're locked into the prices you see. But online, you can compare prices and go for the best value." Over the years, Amazon and other online retailers have added features to attract more customers. Many let customers leave public reviews and ratings. Instead of talking with a salesperson in a store, you can read hundreds of opinions from other online shoppers. Internet retailers have also sped up delivery. Items that you order online can arrive on your doorstep in a day or two, or sometimes even within hours. On the top of page 12 is a photo of Jeff Bezos that was taken in 1997. He is kneeling next to a stack of books in an Amazon warehouse, because back then, Amazon only sold books. The rise of online shopping isn't without drawbacks. The growth of e-commerce has made it harder for some in-person stores to succeed. In the past decade, Sears, Toys R Us, and several other large retailers have closed their physical stores. And this year alone, more than 3,200 storefronts have closed in the United States. That is according to CoreSite, a company that tracks retail and technology data. Some people also worry about e-commerce's environmental impact. The data centers needed to process online orders use vast amounts of energy, and millions of trees are cut down to make all those boxes that arrive on our doorsteps daily. But other people point out that e-commerce has positive effects too. For example, some retailers have successfully used online sales to increase foot traffic in their physical stores, such as by encouraging customers to pick up and return internet orders in person. And not all of online shopping's impact on the planet is bad. a single truck delivering products to many homes can be less harmful to the environment than a bunch of shoppers individually driving to different stores, logistics experts say. Plus, some online sellers have been trying to make deliveries more climate-friendly by switching to electric delivery vehicles. The rise of online shopping has also affected how we interact. Trips to the store with friends or family offer a way for people to connect and for young people to discover what they like and don't like, says Alexandra Lang. She's the author of Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. However, the younger the customer, the more likely they are to shop online. Going to a mall where there are lots of different kinds of shops is one way teens and tweens explore their identities, because they can try on different things with friends in a non-judgmental way, Lang says. That's a loss with online shopping. E-commerce is expected to keep growing. Some companies, including J.Crew and Bloomingdale's, have introduced cyber stores where people can shop in virtual reality. But experts predict that online shopping won't completely replace in-person shopping, which still represents about 80% of retail sales in the U.S., according to Statista. The social aspect of shopping is part of why Lang and others expect in-person stores to stick around. Shopping isn't just about buying something new, Lang says. It's about all the things you do around the shopping experience and who you're having that experience with. The article on page 14 is, Where is the Lost Inca Gold? Nearly 500 years ago, an Inca general hid hundreds of tons of gold to keep it from Spanish invaders. Are those riches somewhere in these mountains? The picture on page 14 and 15 is of the majestic Andes mountain range that runs through five countries in South America. And photos of several priceless gold pieces made by Inca craft workers. Many more may lie hidden in the Longaniz mountain range in Ecuador. The year is 1533. The place is a steep mountain trail in South America's Inca Empire. 60,000 Inca men trudge along, bent under heavy loads of gold. Guarding them are 12,000 soldiers. All are on a mission of utmost importance to save the life of their emperor, Atahualpa. Hundreds of miles away, in the city of Cajamarca, soldiers from Spain are holding Atahualpa prisoner. They have agreed to free him in exchange for enough gold to fill a large room. Suddenly, a messenger arrives at the trail with terrible news. The emperor is dead. The Spanish soldiers have killed him. At that moment, Ruminayawi, the Inca general leading the mission, makes a vow that will become the stuff of legend. No outsider will ever possess this gold, because he will hide it where it will never be found. Today, nearly 500 years later, the Inca treasure would be worth an estimated $5 billion. But its location remains one of history's great mysteries. The Inca civilization arose in the Andes Mountains in the 12th century. By Atahualpa's time, the Inca Empire was the world's largest nation, stretching from present-day Colombia to Chile. It was home to about 12 million people. The Inca were skilled farmers and engineers. They constructed a network of roads and bridges connecting the vast empire. Master stonemasons built complex mountaintop cities and fortresses. Much of their territory was, and still is, rich in minerals, including gold, copper, silver, and zinc. The gold that miners dug from the earth had immense value to the Inca, but not as a sign of wealth. To them, the bright metal was the sweat of Inti, their sun god. Craft workers fashioned it into sacred objects, jeweled cups, masks of the sun god, and statues. Word of such wonder spread. Around 1526, Francisco Pizarro, a Spanish soldier, was exploring South America's Pacific coast. He heard stories of Inca gold and saw some of it with his own eyes. Where he came from, a small pile of gold would turn a pauper into a wealthy man. A large pile could raise a wealthy man to great power and privilege. Pizarro claimed Inca territory and its gold for Spain. In 1532, he arrived at Cajamarca to tell Atahualpa so. When the emperor rejected Spain's claim, Pizarro's soldiers ambushed him. Pizarro had fewer than 200 men, while Atahualpa had tens of thousands camped outside the city. But the Spanish had guns. Armed only with clubs and spears, the Inca were overpowered. The emperor was taken hostage. Rumiñahui and others raced to gather the gold to free him. Rumiñahui had collected about 750 tons of gold. Where could he have stashed so much treasure? He and his men had been traveling south from the city of Quito. Some historians think they hid it nearby, in the Yanganazi mountain ranges in the Andes. About 50 years after the emperor's death, a Spanish man named Jose Valverde claimed to know the gold's location. He wrote that his father-in-law, an Inca, had shown him the site as a wedding gift. Valverde became wealthy, which seemed to verify his story. But no one who followed his directions could find the gold. In 1886, a Canadian treasure hunter named Barth Blake also claimed to have found it. He wrote of thousands of gold and silver pieces, life-size human figures made out of beaten gold and silver, birds, animals, corn stalks, gold and silver flowers, and much more. Too much, Blake claimed, for thousands of men to move. Apparently intending to return, Blake left Ecuador, then mysteriously disappeared. On the bottom of page 16, the information box asks you the question, if you were an Inca, what might your life have been like in the early 16th century? And we see examples of the typical food that you would have raised yourself, how you might have kept records of important events using colored thread instead of writing things down, and even the different gods you would have worshipped for rainfall and crop growth. Modern adventurers have taken up the search, but new technology is of little use in the Llanganates. The region ranges from about 4,000 feet above sea level to nearly 15,000 feet. Starting at about 8,000 feet, air becomes very thin, meaning it has less oxygen. Even experienced climbers find it hard to breathe and will get sick if they don't give their bodies enough time to adjust. Also, it's often cold and very wet. The Llanganates gets up to 157 inches of rain a year, and when a thick fog moves in, as it frequently does, it's impossible to see more than a few feet in any direction. Broken bones from slips and falls are a constant risk. So are cuts from the sharp-edged grasses that grow there, or accidents with machetes, the large knives needed to hack a path through dense vegetation. After Atahualpa's death, the Inca resisted Spain's claim on their land. as Spanish troops poured in from the north, Rumanyauti returned to Quito to help defend the city. About a year later, in 1534, he was captured. Even under torture, Rumanyauti refused to reveal where he had put the gold. He went to his death rather than betray the secret. Spain divided the Inca Empire into colonies ruled by Spanish governors. But revolts continued to break out until 1572, when the last Inca leader was defeated. Today, descendants of the Inca still live in the region, mainly in Ecuador and Peru. Rumanyauti is remembered as a hero, and the mystery of where he hid the treasure lives on. On page 18, Junior Scholastic presents True Teens of History, and the name of the article is The Code That Changed the World. At just 15, Louis Braille invented a revolutionary way for blind people to read and write. When Louis Braille was very young, he would toddle into his father's workshop. Simon René Braille was a master saddle maker, and strips of leather filled the dusty room. Louis loved to watch his father cut and fasten the leather to make saddles for horses. He was especially captivated by the shiny tools on his father's workbench. One day, when Louis was 3, his father stepped outside to chat with a customer. Louis picked up one of the sharp tools and tried to punch a hole in the leather like his father, but the tool slipped, piercing his right eye. Louis howled in pain. Both his eyes had become dangerously inflamed. It was 1812 in France, and modern medicine was still a long way off. There was little that doctors could do as the boy's world went dark. By the time Louis turned 5, he was blind. Louis's future seemed bleak. In the early 19th century, blind children were often abandoned to the streets, left to beg for food. But Louis would defy the odds. At his family's urging, he got an education, and as a young teen, Louis invented Braille, a system of reading and writing for the blind. Braille uses raised dots to represent letters and numbers that can be read by touch. Louis's incredible creation opened up new opportunities for people who are blind or low vision. The youngest of 4 children, Louis was born on January 4, 1809, in the village of Comprove, France. He lived before modern conveniences like cars and electricity, but the bright boy would soon be ahead of his time. After Louis's accident, his family encouraged him to be independent and resourceful. His father carved a wooden cane, and Louis began using it to tap his way around the house. With each tap, he learned how to feel what was in front of him so he could get around safely. Little by little, Louis ventured further. First, he navigated his family's garden, then the stony paths around his town. Simone René dreamed that his son would soon one day read and write. He hammered nails into wood in the shapes of letters for Louis to trace with his fingers. As Louis got older, he started attending a nearby school. By listening to his lessons, he became one of the school's best students. Still, he grew frustrated that he was unable to read or write like his peers. Then, in 1819, at age 10, Louis received a scholarship to attend the Royal Institute for Blind Youth in Paris, France. It was the world's first school for blind students. He was among the very privileged, says Georgina Cleage. She's an expert on disability studies who's been blind since she was 11. The idea that a blind person would be educated was really radical. At school, Lewis was surrounded for the first time by other students who were blind. He became passionate about music and learned to play the cello, piano, and organ by ear. Lewis and his classmates took classes such as grammar and math, relying on memory to learn the material. Students at the school read by tracing embossed or raised letters with their fingers, but reading this way was slow and difficult, with just a sentence or two fitting on a page. And because embossed books were expensive to print, the school's library had only 14. They were too big to be carried around, and pressing on the pages to read them wore out the letters over time. There are accounts of blind readers from very early on who would read until their fingers bled, says Sari Ashulter, a professor at Northeastern University who focuses on disability studies. You had to press so hard on the pages. And writing was out of the question for many of the students. It required memorizing the shapes of the embossed letters and recreating them on paper with ink. Students who managed to get that far couldn't even read back what they'd written. Lewis knew there had to be a better way. When Lewis was 12, Charles Barbier, a French Army veteran, visited the school. Barbier had developed a new system of reading and writing. It used raised dots, arranged in groups of 12, to represent letters or sounds. Known as night writing, the system allowed soldiers to read Army orders like advance or withdraw in the dark. While night writing was a big improvement over embossed letters, there were drawbacks. The system involved many dot combinations, making it hard to learn. The combinations were too large to feel with one touch, and there was no spelling, punctuation, or numbers. But Lewis was inspired. He began punching holes into paper with one goal in mind, to refine Barbier's system into a code that would be easier to use. Lewis placed a sheet of heavy paper onto a board called a slate. Then he used a pointed tool known as a stylus to punch holes into the paper. When Lewis flipped the paper over, he could feel the raised dots. He spent nearly 3 years turning those dots into a system of reading and writing. He based it on groups of 6 dots, 2 across and 3 down. He created a specific pattern for each letter of the alphabet. By 1824, at age 15, Lewis had invented the earliest version of Braille. He would go on to add patterns for capital letters, numbers, and punctuation. What made Braille especially groundbreaking, Clegg says, is that it gave blind people a way to write. For the first time, they wouldn't need anyone's help to record their ideas. The writing part was huge, she explains. Braille allowed blind people to write for themselves and to be able to read what they've written. Despite its revolutionary potential, Braille didn't take off overnight. Some people worried that teaching blind and low-vision children their own code might further isolate them from the world. Still, Lewis kept inventing. He devised a code for math, and he created music symbols so blind musicians could read and compose music. And in 1829, he published a book introducing Braille to the world, Procedure for Writing Words, Music, and Plain Song by Means of Dots. In 1833, Lewis became a teacher at his school. He would instruct blind youth there for nearly 2 decades. He also helped create a new dot system called raphigraphy. In it, raised dots form the shapes of traditional letters, The goal was to bridge the gap so blind and sighted people could write to each other. But raffigraphy took a long time to produce by hand. By the early 1840s, Lewis found a way to make the process faster. He worked with a friend, Pierre Foucault, who was also blind, to build a machine called a raffigraph, who could produce raised dot letters. Though his mind remained active, Lewis was often sick with lung-related illnesses. He died at the age of 43 in Paris in 1852, 2 years before France adopted Braille as its official reading and writing system for blind people. The United States adopted a uniform Braille system in 1932. Today, 200 years after its creation, Braille is considered one of the world's greatest inventions. The raised dot system is everywhere, in museums and offices, and on elevator buttons, ATMs, and more. Braille codes are used in more than 133 languages around the globe. Even now, the system continues to change lives. Studies show that blind people who use Braille are more likely to be employed. In France, Lewis's childhood home is now a museum. There, a plaque highlights Lewis's historic accomplishment. He opened the doors of knowledge to all those who cannot see. On the upper right of page 20 is a picture of a device called a raffigraph, which was the first writing machine for blind people. It was created by Lewis and a friend in the 1840s to type out traditional letters in raised dots. And the last article in this month's edition of Junior Scholastic is, Should Election Day Be a National Holiday? Millions of Americans don't vote in national elections. Would giving them the day off from school and work boost turnout? On Tuesday, November 5th, Americans across the country will vote for president, but not everyone who is able to vote will take part. For many people, finding time to cast a ballot on a weekday can be tricky. Work, school, and other commitments get in the way. Only about two-thirds of eligible Americans voted in the most recent presidential election in 2020. That means about 80 million people did not vote. Voters must be at least 18 and U.S. citizens. Even fewer Americans vote in midterm elections when some members of the U.S. Congress are up for election. Getting more people to vote is important, some lawmakers say. The United States is a democracy, a type of government in which citizens elect their leaders. A democracy works only if people take part, they argue. Earlier this year, a bill was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives to make Election Day a national holiday. If the bill becomes law, most people who work for the federal government would get Election Day a paid day off. Private companies could choose whether to give their workers a day off, too. This isn't the first time such a bill has been introduced, but critics say making Election Day a holiday would create other problems, especially for voters who don't get paid for days off. Turning Election Day into a federal holiday would free more people up to vote, supporters say. By law, Election Day falls on the Tuesday following the first Monday in November. That is a weekday, when many adults work and teens old enough to vote are in class. Nearly 27% of voting-age Americans who didn't cast a ballot in 2022 reported being too busy with jobs or school, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. No one should be unable to vote because they have to work, says Anna Eshoo, a U.S. representative from California. She introduced the bill in February. More than a dozen states have already made Election Day a state holiday. However, those state laws vary. Not all require employers to give workers paid time off to vote, and the amount of time employees do get differs. Supporters say a federal law would be fairer, setting the same rules for every state and giving more Americans a chance to vote. The change would also remind people that elections should be a priority, said James Mansbridge, a political science professor at Harvard University in Massachusetts. Each vote counts toward outcomes that will affect everyone else in the country, she explains. But critics say that adding Election Day as a federal holiday would not guarantee a higher voter turnout. Private companies could decide not to give their workers the day off, and essential employees like doctors, nurses, and police officers would still have to work. Even people who would get the day off could still face headaches. David Becker is the executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. His organization studies voting trends. On national holidays, he points out, schools are typically closed and public transportation runs on reduced schedules. This could cause problems for people who need childcare or who rely on trains and buses to get to the polls, he says. In addition, many people, especially low-income workers, do not get paid for days they don't work. There are better ways to increase turnout, some people say. For instance, some states could pass laws that expand early voting, whether in person or by mail. In 2020, about 70% of people who voted cast their ballots before Election Day. Such changes would make a bigger difference than a national holiday, some election experts say. And that's all for this installment of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Volunteer, Kathy Danaher. So long, until next month.